And so I suppose for me, the most important is trying to make sure we understand the issues we've and the missteps we've made before, and how do we ensure we don't do that in the future? So whilst we're shifting, whilst we're adjusting and moving into the greener, cleaner energy space, can we ensure that we do so without human rights atrocities?
Climate change is so much more than global warming and emissions, but it is the ecological breakdown of the entirety of Earth's systems. Ironically, this crisis of human creation is now the largest threat to human systems and human rights. Last year, the UN even recognized for the first time the human right to a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment. Climate change not only creates new threats, but exacerbates existing ones. For example, resource insecurity, falling insecurity and instability in further vulnerable regions, sometimes regions which are already facing civil war and conflict. The major policy challenge going forward will be implementing the necessary change to economies and behavioral patterns with a transborder awareness of the global reach of the problem and the solution. From the University of Cambridge and the Centre of Governance and Human Rights, my name is Nima Jayasinghe, and I am your host for this episode of Declarations. I also have with me in the studio Amy Hopley as a panelist who will help lead the discussion. And I also have Kristen, the Director of Global Plastic Action Partnership, and who is leading the World Economic Forum's Resource Circularity Mission here with us today. Kristen, it is an absolute honor to have you with us. Kristen is also a member of the Executive Committee. The project seeks to engage governments, stakeholders, and majority players to implement systemic change to the way we consume and waste materials, an indispensable pillar of global climate action change to stay on track for net zero and design sustainable systems compatible with planetary limits. With that quick introduction, I'm going to pass it over to our panelist, Amy. Amy, take it away.
Okay. Hi, Kristen. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And thank you so much for agreeing to talk about this issue, because obviously I think it's obviously a really important issue, but I just don't think the link is often made explicit enough between basically climate change and human rights. I mean, climate change is going to be the most significant threat to human rights going forward. As I say, I think this is a really important conversation to be having. So to start off, could you just give a brief kind of introduction, like what do you do and what are your initial thoughts on what we're talking about today?
Thanks, Amy. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here to chat with you about this really important topic. I oversee the resource circularity pillar at the World Economic Forum, which sits within our Center for Nature and Climate, really looking at holistic ways to develop circular economy approaches to trying to support our mitigation on climate change. And one of our key aspects in driving that change forward is really thinking about the current energy transition from fossil fuels to low carbon energy. It's not just how do we make that happen overnight? But it's also how do we ensure that it's done in a way that is just and fair and also, again, as circular as possible?
No, absolutely. And kind of leading on basically from exactly what you've just said, with this kind of transition that we're seeing, I mean, obviously it's a great thing. Governments, countries around the world are really starting to turn climate ambition into climate action. We've got net zero transitions, we've got green transition and all of this. But with that, for example, an increased demand for rare earth materials, I mean, this has been called in some circles a new scramble for Africa. I mean, what do you think is the danger of this new scramble for Africa and this new source of insecurity being created out of a response to climate change?
Well, we know that central to the shift into a way to support climate change mitigation and to have the shift into the clean and greener energy is that we're going to still need to see a massive increase in the use of renewables. And some of this has to do with rechargeable batteries, electric vehicles, and things that help with renewable energy storage units. And a lot of the work that goes into creating those batteries and those storage units ends up needing a lot of very critical materials and rare earths. What I thought was really interesting when I look at some of the research I've done is that even organizations like Amnesty International will tell you that they recognize the importance of mining in order for us to have this transition in fighting climate change and transitioning into a cleaner energy. However, of course, an organization like Amnesty and myself, we want to push that transition is done in a very fair and just way. And so when you mention places like Africa, DRC is one of the largest places where you'll find cobalt. And so we want to ensure that cobalt is actually mined in a way that supports the miners, that there isn't human rights abuses taking place in those mines, that children are not being used to mine the cobalt. And so it is actually a very growing and large issue. It even goes beyond Africa. I'll tell you, I mean, when we think about the big components that will be needed to power electric cars and buses, it's not just cobalt. You'll also need copper, nickel, lithium. These are all very key components. And yet each one of them will be mined in certain ways and in certain areas where we start to run into some tensions, both from a geopolitical perspective, but certainly also from a human rights and a personnel perspective.
No, absolutely. And on the point of cobalt in the DRC, I mean, I think it's about 75% of the global cobalt supply is mined in the DRC. But then we've also got a situation where, for example, a large proportion of those mines might be Chinese owned. They might, you know, there's a regulation problem, I think. And so do you have any insight onto how this regulation problem might be standardized?
It's a great question, and certainly one that we are trying to grapple with as well within the World Economic Forum, because we are looking to build out these multi-stakeholder platforms that bring companies, civil society organizations, and governments, including China, together to really try to pull together the right kind of regulatory framework that will actually bring about a just transition. And you're right, having one country actually own or manage the majority of this is certainly troublesome. And so we're also trying to think that through from a holistic perspective. One thing that I find a little bit positive is that a lot of countries, and if you look at the EU Green Deal, the European Union is now also trying to think about how can they utilize materials and regulation, even within the EU, that then allows us to have that just transition. So the new battery directive, for example, is not allowing us to ship our batteries to Africa, but rather we need to find a way to recycle them and reuse them and repurpose them here at home in Europe. So that's one way, is at least we're starting to think in our own regulatory environments in Europe and the UK, North America, how can we create the right kind of regulatory framework that keeps us and supports our efforts at home? At the same time, again, trying to have these dialogues with other countries is certainly not always straightforward and super easy, but we are trying to have that multi-stakeholder conversation that brings the governments together with the private sector. And hopefully we can break through with some of the very key and necessary regulations.
Yeah, of course. I think the key point there as well is this kind of this transnational, this holistic, you know, it needs to be horizontal as well as vertical. You need to be aware of kind of the ramifications of not just the problem, but the solutions. And again, you mentioned repurposing at, like in the EU Green Deal. Can you talk a bit about the circular economy transition that's occupying a massive space in the EU Green Deal, the UK net zero transition, that kind of thing?
Well, what I liked is the way you were talking about horizontals and verticals. And I was thinking, ooh, but let's talk about circular. And of course, you know, the circular economy is really trying to challenge the linear economy's business as usual approach. And so traditionally, how we've always utilized things is through this take, make, waste. So we take product, we make something out of it, and then we just throw it away. So what we're trying to do now as circular economy is really think about how can we employ tactics and strategies that eliminate waste, that upcycle materials, and really help these things have a whole new lease on life that normally would just end up in landfill and rubbish. And this is also not just thinking about downstream. It's not just thinking about recycling and reuse and repurpose, but the circular economy really is something that's needs to be taken into consideration in the design of new products as well. So many times we see some things, like if you look at an automobile from the 70s, we will have seen a lot of different kinds of steel and aluminium pulled together, and it's difficult to know what kinds of products are now melted in that car. So we are having a difficult time actually recycling some of those components. However, if we think about the design, where especially with so many different kinds of technology, RFID, that can actually help us to track, we actually, when that product comes to the end of its life, we should be able to build it back all the way back to the molecules it was originally and then completely rebuild it. The father of the circular economy, Bill McDonough, talks about this, and he's doing some incredible work even with companies like Nike and their shoe technology. And so really, I think we've got some interesting design opportunities within the circular economy space that will allow us to utilize materials in a way that doesn't waste them. And this in and of itself will also help us with our climate adaptation.
I mean, yeah, of course, because I think a massive risk with this green transition is that, for example, a renewable energy transition, you know, you've got to mitigate that that's not energy addition, even if it's renewable, and it actually does have to be an energy reduction. And what would be your opinion on who's kind of leading this circular transition at the minute? Do you see it as a corporate-led transition? Do you think it's coming from governments, and where do you think it should be coming from to be mobilized quicker?
Well, I think that we all have a role to play. And so when we think about that circular economy design element, I mean, there's a massive opportunity with innovation, entrepreneurs, and new scientists who are thinking through these new design elements. However, like you said, companies definitely also need to be on the forefront of this. And we're seeing a lot of different companies actually being really innovative and creative in the way they are using materials to try to help us with that transition. And so one of them, I mean, we do quite a bit of work with the built environment. And so I've been talking to the Mott McDonald's and the Wholesomes of the world. And actually, it's amazing how they will sometimes tell me that they're further along than public policy allowed them to be sometimes. And they recognize that, especially during COVID and some of the headwinds that they had with supply chain shortages, they had to figure out how they can actually be more circular with their operations just in order to get materials that they needed. And so it was really fascinating to hear some of their anecdotes where they recognize circular economy is not just good for the environment, but it's really good for the company, really good for the business, really good for the bottom line. Wholesome, for example, have created a way to reuse cement, which is one of the hardest to abate items out there. And we're trying to find ways to reduce the climate impact of cement. Well, one way is by recycling it. Wholesome have figured this out, and yet only one country in all of Europe currently allows the use of recycled cement, and that is Switzerland. So you have Wholesome ready with all this material that could really support in other countries. So you definitely need businesses to be ready to be moving forward, and it's great to see these companies that are on the forefront. However, we also very much need government with the regulations in a positive way to also remove the barriers to some of this progress.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the fact that one country allows the recycling of cement, even though it's obviously now been proven as a reliable avenue, I mean, that's quite shocking. What do you think is, I worry about using this word, but the excuse that governments are using for not scaling up their policy sufficiently enough, not fully embracing green industrial policy in the way that they should be. I mean, what excuse are governments continually using?
I mean, I do love that word. I think it certainly sparks a certain kind of energy when you think what excuse. I mean, I did work in government early in my career, and I can say it's tough sometimes just to figure out how to prioritize. Governments are trying to grapple with so many different things. And you think even within the space of one of the efforts that I lead is in the plastic space, and how do we address plastic pollution. Well, sometimes we talk to a government and they say, we really want to address plastic pollution, but we also need to address this EV issue. We need to supply opportunities for people to be able to recharge their battery. And so they have to make these trade-offs. And so I would say, I don't know that governments are trying to come up with an excuse for why they're not progressing this and not removing those hindrances, but it's rather just how they can prioritize. And I think a lot of that is, again, how we can bring the education to the forefront so governments can understand what the opportunities are. And sometimes they just simply don't know. And so utilizing our conversations, utilizing our platforms, we can have these discussions and really educate the governments on what the potential is, what the possibility is, what the hindrances are, and then how can we remove those roadblocks for greater good. And again, when I think about the battery value chain, for example, I mean, a huge opportunity for governments actually to lead the energy transition that really ends up in replicating, you know, let's avoid the replicating of the injustices from the fossil fuel. So governments, I think, are seeing and hearing at times a lot of different opportunities. But we, the collective individuals, students, academics, scientists, and businesses all need to be able to educate government on what it will take for us to get there and then hopefully help them to prioritize.
Yeah, absolutely. But as well as kind of mobilizing that will and the ability for governments to prioritize, to what extent do you think capacity is a limitation? I mean, earlier we were discussing the DRC and kind of mining anywhere in the world that these rare earths might be. How do you think a global climate response can grapple with not being a kind of repeat of fossil fuel post-colonial interests that a lot of past energy struggles have surfaced? How do you think we can kind of grapple with that, but also the reality that there needs to be a kind of capacity and there also needs to be some kind of policy standardization and that kind of thing?
I mean, a policy standardization is a great step forward. One of the things that I was approached about in the last few weeks is a South-South conversation. One thing that we're also hearing from the Global South is they don't necessarily want Global North countries coming in and telling them what to do, but they want to learn from each other. And this we've seen this in conversations around deforestation and other climate-related issues as well. And with the just transition, there could be a tremendous opportunity for countries and governments to work together in that collective effort to standardize, like you were talking about. Similarly, I think by bringing that capacity to light that you've hinted at, how can we help educate governments from a business perspective, from a civil society perspective? Again, I mentioned Amnesty. I think they're doing an amazing job to hold businesses' feet to the fire and really ensure that businesses that position themselves as global sustainability leaders are actually doing the right thing when it comes to human rights and the environmental stances that they seem to take. And so Amnesty, I think, is also trying to, and others, I don't mean to just focus on them. I know there are quite a few who focus on this, but, you know, centering that respect for human rights, understanding the role of business, understanding the role investors play, and then bringing all of that to government and allowing governments to have government conversations, government to government. I'm certainly very hopeful that we can prevent human rights abuses and certainly mitigate environmental harm at the same time.
Yeah, of course, because as well as the direct environmental and ecological threat of climate change, I mean, undeniably, it's this kind of insecurity, like exacerbating existing insecurity, existing war, conflict, fights for resources, that this kind of thing. You know, you've got water, you've got food. So the human rights threat is so multifaceted. What do you think, I mean, again, probably an impossible question, but a few things that you think should be prioritised in the global effort going forward so that human rights are at the centre of a climate transition without limiting it in any way from the speed and scale necessary for the transition?
Yeah, it's a great question because, I mean, one of the clearest threats is in being created by the current ecological climate crisis is insecurity, as you mentioned. And we're seeing things happen around the world, things like drought. And what we saw right after the COVID pandemic was this terrible food insecurity, which also came from the Ukraine situation. And so how can we ensure that we're able to support water shortage, food shortage, and other issues that arise out of resource and weather insecurity? And so we're seeing lots of different issues come about with weather disruption that we also think is due to climate change issues. And so again, there's this whole domino effect, and some people call it the butterfly effect as well, right? So one step leads to the next to the next. And so it is tough to really think when you say, and I like the question because you're like, what is the number one thing? What's that first step we can take? It's hard to have one. And I think that's almost why when I think about things as circular, there isn't necessarily a hierarchy. I mean, we definitely need to reduce our emissions. We need to shift to an electrification and a green energy. But again, in doing so, we need to figure out the right way to store and the right way to build and rebuild and reuse solar panels and wind turbines and battery storage. And so almost all of our answers come with new questions. And so I suppose for me, the most important is trying to make sure we understand the issues we've and the missteps we've made before, and how do we ensure we don't do that in the future? So whilst we're shifting, whilst we're adjusting and moving into the greener, cleaner energy space, can we ensure that we do so without human rights atrocities, without additional environment issues? And I think, again, within even that space, thinking about mining, we are going to have to create new mines. We're going to have to extract copper, cobalt, lithium, nickel, etc., in order for this green, clean energy transition to happen. Well, how can we ensure that that mining is done environmentally and socially responsibly? Mining takes a lot of water and a lot of human capacity. So I feel like there's a lot of lessons that we can learn from the past, and hopefully we can use those and build on those so that we don't replicate the issues of the past.
Absolutely. And that's not to make it sound daunting for everyone listening, because, I mean, really, this transition, it's an opportunity. It's not, I mean, of course, it's a bad thing what's happening, but the transition is not a bad thing. It's an opportunity. So, you know, everything you've highlighted, I mean, I found that really interesting. I hope everyone listening also did. And I also hope it made them think about a lot of the questions you raised and might not have answered fully. I hope it will encourage people to go out and read more about what interested them specifically. On that, would you like to maybe recommend for our listeners maybe something you've read recently, or it doesn't have to be recently, or somewhere they can go to look if they would like to learn more about anything we've discussed today?
Yes, thank you for that. And you're right. I don't want it to be daunting. There's a lot of opportunity. And I think when we think and we look at the green energy transition, there are job opportunities, there will be economic opportunities. So we actually can make this a positive move. I just want to continue to preach that we do so thoughtfully. Some of the reports, I know that, of course, the World Economic Forum has a wealth of knowledge and so many reports on the electrification, on the just energy transition, as well as on the circular economy, if I can make my own plug. And of course, I mentioned today Amnesty International. There are also, they've got some tremendous research that they're putting together in the space of human rights and how human rights in the just transition can be engaged as we support electrification.
That sounds great. I'm definitely going to go and read some of those myself now. But thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for answering our questions. And I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did.
I did, Amy. I really enjoyed the conversation. And I thank you again for giving me the opportunity to chat with you today.
Amy and Kristen, thank you so much for that lovely, lovely discussion. We hope you have enjoyed today's podcast. For those listening, if you do have any questions or comments, please do find us on Twitter via @declarationspod or like us on Facebook. You can also send us an email at editor@declarationspod.com. We would love to hear your thoughts on today's discussion. You can also check out our website, where each episode has a companion piece with more information about the episode and links to additional resources. These packages are put together by a show notes writer. With that, thank you so much for listening, and please do subscribe to either Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and tune in next week for more declarations.